Now you listen to me, and I'll only say this once. We are not sick men. Welcome to my dojo. This is Kung Fu Pizza Party. I'm your host, Brandon Knight, and today I am here to honor Bruce Lee's birthday with a review of what is arguably his best film, Fist of Fury. For those of you dropping in for the very first time, here on Kung Fu Pizza Party, I seek to deliver high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and serve up some wisdom one slice at a time. And for those of you returning, hi, I know it's been a minute since the last time we've been together here on the show. Had some technical difficulties here throughout the early part of November. You see, my laptop turned in its 2 weeks, and so I had to hire a replacement. And so here I am now, back and ready to go with a brand new piece of tech, nice and shiny, and with plenty of space for me to put stickers on it. So, but it's good to be back with you all today, and excited for what the rest of 2025 has here for the show. But let's get right down to business. And like I said, this is arguably Bruce Lee's best film, and I think it is at least safe to say that it is my favorite Bruce Lee film. Normally, when we talk about Bruce Lee's best work, I think most people's minds are going to go to Enter the Dragon. It is certainly the movie that moved the Kung Fu movie genre, the Hong Kong action film, from kind of this like B niche category to more mainstream. It was a very mainstream audience that was that this film was made for. You had John Saxon in it as one of the co-main leads. Like, it definitely is the movie that most people, I would assume, go to, as it had the biggest reach. It came out right after Bruce's death, so it got a lot of publicity surrounding that. And of course, you have the iconic mirror fight scene at the end of Enter the Dragon. I also think that if you're going to that there's probably going to be some very pretentious person out there who would say Way of the Dragon is Bruce's best work. And here's the thing about Way of the Dragon. Yes, it does establish, or at least I think, I don't know this for a fact, and I'll talk about it more when I get to that movie. Way of the Dragon at least has what is a very common Kung Fu movie trope that actually Jackie Chan utilizes in a lot of his films, especially in like his late 80s, early 90s, coming to Hollywood style films, of the fish out of water. The person who's removed from their context usually has some kind of relation to somebody involved in this new culture, usually an uncle. This is the general plot line of Way of the Dragon, but the real reason why certain people would probably say Way of the Dragon is because, of course, that is the iconic Bruce Lee versus Chuck Norris Coliseum fight. When it comes to Fist of Fury, though, it is truly, I think, his best picture, and I would say has the strongest potential, or the strongest arguments, I would say, to be his best film. So let's talk about some of this. One of the reasons why I would say Fist of Fury, also known as The Chinese Connection, is Bruce Lee's best movie is because it is the movie that I think of his film catalog feels the most like a complete film. It is a movie, and what I mean by that is it is a movie that even from a 2025 viewer standpoint, it still maintains a hold on the audience, I guess is what I'm trying to say here. I've talked about before, given some of the movies I have reviewed here on the show, like The Clones of Bruce Lee, and honestly, even a movie as iconic like Drunken Master, a lot of the 70s Hong Kong films, Hong Kong action films, It is action first, plot second. It is, we're just here to have some good old fashioned mindless violence. Whereas a lot of like modern action films, the fights are used as a plot device to move the story along, but they're like the story takes place center. Fist of Fury does an amazing job of being chock full of awesome fight sequences that even if you haven't seen this movie, you have seen some of these fight sequences. I'll talk about that here in a second, but there's like chock full of really good fight sequences, action sequences, but also still being very story heavy. This is a very story driven film. This movie kind of falls into the same category as Legend of the Red Dragon, starring Jet Li, that I talked about earlier this year, where it is semi-historical. Like, there is a historical backdrop and a real historical person that is a part of this story, but there is the actual like story itself is fictional. In this movie, Bruce Lee plays Chen Zhen. Okay, this is a fictional character, but he is a student of, I apologize, I am not going to say this name well, so I apologize ahead of time. He is a student of Ho Yongjia. Ho Yongjia, who is a historical Chinese martial artist hero. There's all these folklores and legends and real history about this man. So, and in this story, Bruce Lee's character, Chen Zhen, is avenging Ho's murder. Another historical aspect of this film is that, similar to When Taekwondo Strikes, this movie is centered around Japanese occupation of China. This is about Japanese imperialism and their colonization of Asia during the 1940s time period. Excuse me, not 1940s, early 1900s. I wanted to look that part up real quick before we continued on. So this is about the Japanese occupation of China, and Ho has been murdered, and it is up to Chen Zhen to avenge his death. And again, talking about this movie as kind of this like complete film, not something that is just telling a story so we can see a lot of good action, but has both a really good story and a lot of really good action sequences. This movie begs the question, when is nationalism appropriate? And this is another reason why I think this is Bruce Lee's best film, is because this is the one that I think communicates a very strong message. When is your cultural identity the most important thing? And what this movie shows is that there is a sense, there is a place for a proper sense of nationalism when a foreign invader comes in to squash, destroy, and dismantle you. When a foreign oppressor comes in, a power comes in to oppress another people group, the people being oppressed have a right to a level of nationalistic pride in themselves and in their culture to rise up and to fight against the oppressor, which is why there is such irony that I'm recording this on Thanksgiving and that I'm a white man of Anglo-Saxon descent, like on my dad's side. I'm Polish on my mama's side. Let me know in the comments if I'm Polish on my mama's side needs to be on a t-shirt. Yes, that has a nice little ring to it, if I do say so myself. But the irony of all of this is that when you, here in the U.S., where we have Christian nationalism and white privilege, white nationalism of people who have been the oppressor or people who have held all of the authority, all of the power, and now suddenly, I shouldn't say suddenly, and now we're in a stage in history where that is being challenged, and there are people, rightfully so, people who have been oppressed, rising up to say, hey, stop oppressing us. We would also like a piece of the pie, because here in the U.S., everyone's supposed to have an equal opportunity. It's the great big melting pot. I was indoctrinated by Schoolhouse Rock, by the way. It was the great American melting pot, and everyone's supposed to have this equal opportunity, even though from the get-go we were oppressing the Native Americans, the First Nations people, we just came in and took over, right? So that is the difficulty of me talking about this, and it is that balance, it is that power imbalance that we need to maintain, because those of a white nationalist or Christian nationalist perspective are going to say, you know, well, we are being oppressed by feminism and liberalism and all the other stuff. And it's like, no, you hold the power and the authority, and all of the patriarchy holds the power. Like, these are people who have been oppressed. They have earned the right, in a sense, to have pride in themselves, in their cultures, in their whatever, to say, we deserve to be represented and treated like human beings and have opportunity as well. And when you have a Bruce Lee movie making me think and process and talk about something like that, you know you have something special here on your hands. Let's also not forget that this is a podcast devoted to martial art fighting. And like I said earlier, this movie has iconic fight scenes, whether you've actually seen the movie or not. There is one particular scene, two particular scenes actually, that have been utilized in advertising throughout the years. One of them comes at the very end of the movie. There is the final fight is Bruce Lee versus the Japanese have befriended this Russian fighter. He's this big, white, strong dude. He's not Bob Wall, but he certainly does look like they were going for Bob Wall, who is going to show up in other Bruce Lee projects later on. But in this fight sequence between Bruce and not Bob Wall, Bruce does this, it's in slow motion to the point where they also have like the graphics, so that way it looks like you can see his hands as he's doing this movement very slowly. In this fight sequence, he does this Wing Chun arm practicing, it's a blocking drill. Really. And it's you have seen this before. I guarantee you've seen it before, either mimicked in other movies. I think it does come up in The Last Dragon. I think he does do this once he gets the glow. He does do this movement. But it's this really slow blocking technique from Wing Chun. And it's, like I said, it's been parodied. It's been utilized in commercials. The other one is when Bruce shows up to throw down at the Japanese dojo. So after Ho is killed, they don't know. They initially, Chen Zhen's school is led to believe that he just died unexpectedly, suddenly. It's like this whole big mystery investigation thing for Bruce Lee to discover that, oh no, it's actually the Japanese have murdered him and all this. And so after they have this funeral, that's how the movie opens. It's like the funeral of the master. The students are all gathered together, and they're the new like instructor for the dojo is telling them, like, hey, we still need to follow Ho's teachings and not look to start fights and the whole bit. And then the Japanese show up and they're like, you're all scum, you're dogs, you're all this kind of like, you know, just belittling them, trying to rile them up to get them to fight. And they're like, no, we're not going to fight. We're going to be peaceful. We're going to do the whole thing. And Bruce Lee's like, yeah, Yeah, sure. So he shows up later at the Japanese dojo. They had given him this sign. They had given the school this sign that was like to taunt them. So now he brings it back and he's like, okay, you can have this back. And now I will fight anybody in this dojo. And it ends up being like this. It's a pretty long fight sequence of him just trashing the place. Like he just throws down, levels everybody out. And this is, you have seen this. You have seen this fight sequence before. It has been utilized in commercials before. There is a scene where Bruce Lee, or there's a shot, I should say, during the scene where Bruce Lee is surrounded by Japanese students and the camera angle is above and tilted to the side. And Bruce is kind of turning slowly in the center to like keep his eye on the opponent while everybody kind of encircle him and then start kind of moving around him as well. I guarantee Tarantino has done this shot before, and probably other things, has done this shot before. It's a very cool. It's again, similar to you see this a lot in these Kung Fu movies, even the ones that are kind of like these ones that are a little bit more like action focus driven, where you get like these moments of like really cool cinematography. Because even with the really cool shot, there's a lot of very early on, very subtle ways that they are establishing Bruce Lee as this like outsider. This outsider within his own people and an outsider from the foreign oppressors. When he first arrives on the scene at the funeral, everyone is dressed in like black mourning garbs, but he has this clean white suit on. And then at the dojo, when everybody's now in their uniforms, his fellow classmates are all wearing black uniforms, and he still has his white suit on. Then you go to this dojo scene. And this is very, like, they're wearing, like, the very traditional white uniforms with black belts. Some of them even have more, like, almost like samurai robes on, honestly. And Bruce shows up, and he takes off his shirt, and he is fighting them all shirtless while they are all wearing their more traditional martial art uniforms. And then during the final fight of this tear down of the Japanese dojo, he goes up against their sensei of this dojo, and this guy is a big fella, not like fat, husky. He's a husky guy, okay? And Bruce, who is quite muscular, let's never downplay Bruce Lee's physique, he was also a very small guy. He was very lean. I don't think he was that tall. Actually, hold on. I'm going to find out. I want to know how tall Bruce Lee is. There was reels going around recently of Bruce Lee interacting with Muhammad Ali, and he is just such a short king compared to Muhammad Ali. And Bruce Lee was 5'8", and I'm 5'6", so like we almost would have been eye to eye. Anyway, so you have this like, you have this shot of Bruce going up against this sensei, and Bruce is this lean, muscular guy going up against this tall, husky fellow. This kind of comes back up later on when he has the final fight against the Russian dude as well. So there's a lot of cool, subtle cinematography used as well here to establish, as I said, Bruce Lee as like this separate person compared to everyone else around him. Is it as iconic as Bruce and Chuck fighting in the Colosseum, or the mirror scene in Enter the Dragon, or even the tower scene of Game of Death? I don't know. You really have to, I would really like to at some point like sit down and break down the three biggest fights of Bruce Lee's career, which would be Bruce and Chuck, the tower, and the mirror scene, because at least from a cinematography standpoint, I would say the mirror scene in Enter the Dragon is the best one, because even still to this day, as I'm watching the movie, I still get tricked at points of like where they actually are in the mirror maze. And also it's just impressive that they were able to shoot that scene without ever like showing the cameras. Like that's an extra layer of that's just like an extra layer of thinking of like, we got to make sure that in all of this that we shoot everything at an angle where we also are not in the shot ever. It's just like that attention to detail that, you know, other movies that are coming out around the same time probably wouldn't have like really thought to do, you know. Anyway, back to Fist of Fury. One last reason why I think Fist of Fury is Bruce Lee's best film is because it has the biggest lineage afterwards. I don't think none of Bruce Lee's other films have ever been remade or have a bunch of sequels attached to it. There may be some sequels. Like I said, during the Bruceploitation era, there's all kinds of movies that borrow names and similar plot lines from his movies. So maybe there are for the other films. But the Fist of Fury, and particularly the character Chen Zhen, has become an icon within martial art media. It has produced several sequels and several reboots as well. And I know that in other genres, when we're talking about a lot of sequels and a lot of reboots, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's good. Just look at the Hellraiser franchise, for an example, or really most horror movie franchises, you know, where you have a bunch of dud sequels and reboots and like one or two pretty good additional films. But the reason why I bring up that is because I think this speaks to the power of the message of this movie, the power of this character, Chen Zhen, and also the lineage of who has gone on to play this character and to make films within this, I don't want to say cinematic universe because these films are not connected, but within this like story framework. Because in the 90s, there was a reboot of Fist of Fury starring Jet Li, and then there was a TV series and subsequent film starring Donnie Yen as Chen Zhen. And one of the sequels to Fist of Fury, I think it's the new Fist of Fury, which is taking place during the Bruceploitation era, stars the at the time Leah-like character or Leah-like actor Jackie Chan. So this one character and this one like story framework, because Jackie Chan actually isn't playing Chen Zhen. He's like, I think he's related to him though. And it's been a while since I've seen that one. But within this like story framework and this character, you have four of the most iconic martial art actors throwing their hat into the arena to build this character and to tell these stories. Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Jet Li, Donnie Yen. Just imagine an actual movie with all four of them in it. That would break everything. Not just the internet, all of it. The universe would have exploded. And that's why I think Fist of Fury is the best Bruce Lee film. But I'm starting to run out of time here, so it's time for me to start winding things down. Once again, it's good to be back with you all here today. If you haven't yet already, please consider rating and reviewing the show wherever you get your podcasts. Pass this episode along to a friend. And if you haven't yet already, please check out the show on Instagram at Kung Fu Pizza Party, on Letterboxd, Kung Fu Pizza PRTY, where you get a review of the movie before the episode comes out. And check out my YouTube channel, Studio 219, a place for faith and pop culture. And if you got the time, please also check out the other great shows here on the Anna Zhao Ministries Podcast Network, like Systematic Geekology, the Whole Church podcast and my sister's show, My Seminary Life. Been taking a bit of a break here on the latter half of the year, but got some rebroadcasts coming out over the next few weeks over there, so you don't want to miss those. If you've never checked out the show before, I'm doing a highlight reel through the past few years, my most downloaded episodes year by year, so nice little way to kind of wrap up another year, just kind of looking at all the high points. And speaking of wrapping up another year, throughout the month of December on Instagram, another great reason to go follow the show over there, I'm going to be highlighting the top five most downloaded episodes of 2025. It's been a good year. It's been a fun year for me. Got to spend a lot of it doing all things Karate Kid, and spoiler, a lot of that top five is going to be Karate Kid. There are a few surprises in there. There's one in particular that I'm pleasantly surprised actually made it into the top five, but I don't want to spoil anything. We'll talk about it more when we get there. But thank you all for listening. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party. I've been Brandon Knight, and I will continue to be Brandon Knight. I don't know why I keep saying that. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party, where I've delivered high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and served up some wisdom one slice at a time.